You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I just finished my conversation with Clay Drinko. He's an educator and author of Theatrical Improvisation, Consciousness and Cognition, which is an academic book on improvisation. He writes for Psychology Today and Lifehack about the intersection of improv, science, and the everyday. He's got a new book. It's called Play Your Way Sane, 120 improv-inspired exercises to help you calm down, stop spiraling, and embrace uncertainty. Enjoy the talk.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock.
Clay Drinko, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
When I'm interviewed about my long time at the Second City and how we attract the talent that we have attracted over the decades, I often note that no one got into comedy because they were well-adjusted. Likewise, I think this is true of improvisation and academia. People tend to find these paths because they're looking to fix something in themselves. And this book kind of cops to that, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's a very open and honest look at myself and my own journey with, you know, social anxiety and a host of issues and how improv has helped with those issues.
Yeah, there's a great quote early in the book where you say, quote, if we were already able to live totally in the moment and let everything roll off of our backs, we wouldn't need to numb. We wouldn't need to disengage. You wouldn't have picked up this book and I wouldn't have written it.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was right after I wrote my academic book about how improv affects the mind that I felt, and I talk about this in the new book, Play Your Way Sane, that I felt really hypocritical because I knew I could do better. I knew I was better when I was improvising, and none of it translated to my day-to-day life. I still was a perfectionist and anxious and overthinking and worried. And I talked to a lot. I've spoken to a lot of improvisers that have really similar stories. Then that's why they're drawn to improv, is that it feels so great to take a break from that anxiety and really be in the moment with people on stage. And so this was really my attempt to feel that for myself, to feel that flow and connection and creativity in my everyday life, and to help other people feel the same thing.
You and I belong to a very, very small club, and it might just be you, me, and my wife who have both lived in the sort of academic pursuit, the scientific pursuit of improvisation, but also are very much about, hey, no, this is everyday life because we're just living our lives without scripts.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've always been interested in the performance of everyday life. Even when I was in academia, I was, of course, obsessed with Irving Goffman and mm-hmm. that whole idea that what we're learning about with acting can help us in our everyday lives. I think that's what I've always been interested in, because it's great to be able to give a good performance. It's great to be able to improvise and have people laugh. But like you said in the beginning, what's interesting to me is what do we do with that? How does that improve our lives on a greater scale?
I think working with the social scientists, the one of the most surprising discoveries is the simplest. You say in the book that we all just want to be seen and heard. This is a very, like, this is just like, it is what human beings, we crave connection. We just want to be seen as we see ourselves. And the thing about improvisation is it's literally a practice in that give and take.
Yeah. And so much of it, as I was writing the book, seems so obvious, because it's things that your parents tell you when you're a little kid, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated and make sure you listen and make sure you share and all of those things that, you know, I think improv gives us the set of rules and, you know, principles, whatever you want to call them, that gives us permission to really practice those things that seem like they should be obvious in our adult lives. And I think that's why I'm so drawn to improv. That's why I will never get tired of writing about it and approaching it from different angles, is because it's just a ready-made roadmap to help us see others and hear others and in exchange be seen and be heard. And I think it's so important right now, because a lot of people talk about the importance of being seen and being heard and seeing and hearing others and being mindful. But it doesn't seem to be happening. Right.
Well, that's why you wrote a how-to book. I mean, essentially this is it's not a traditional book of improv games. No. It's not a psychological text, though it draws on all those things. Mm-hmm. It is essentially a bunch of really doable and I think fun prompts that people can, or nudges, I would also say, that people can incorporate into their day-to-day lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I set out to write it, it was very improvisational, the writing of it. I didn't know I would make a lot of references to Kim Kardashian. That was not pre-planned. I didn't know I would tell such embarrassing stories about myself. Right. It really, and the tone of it also is different than anything I've ever done before, because it's not academic. It's how I speak. If my advisor from grad school picks this book up, he's going to be dismayed at how I'm not speaking correctly in correct academic language. But that was the point. This was a book that, just like improv, it's supposed to be super accessible and inviting. And, you know, my status is not supposed to be higher than anyone else's. It's supposed to just be open and, showing up as my true self. It's a roadmap of things that I still do all the time. When I catch myself overthinking or being negative, it's not setting out to be a self-help book that you read it and then, you know, you're a millionaire and you're so happy. It's something that I hope people will integrate into their lives from now on, because we're never going to be finished. I'm never going to be cured and not anxious and always in the moment. But approaching it through games makes it fun for me to try to do that better every day.
Right. When Second City gets hired to do events at conferences, and we're doing a lot of that virtually, I often suggest that we're great as the first thing or the last thing, and sometimes throughout as well. But let's jump into the book, because, you know, you start at a place where I think it's great to start, this idea of how you set the stage, and that in early stage, almost every sort of early stage improv class does the same thing, which is people walk around a room.
Yeah. Yep. The first step always. And I didn't think about it when I was, you know, taking improv classes for 20 years, but it is kind of strange that most improv rehearsals or warm-ups start with just, all right, everybody walk around and don't get stuck in a pattern. And as I was writing the book, I thought, what a great, not only a metaphor, right, of like, before, you know, as we're starting, we need to clear all the chairs, like mm-hmm. clear all the clutter, look around, leave everything that's not pertinent at the door, and focus on where we really are right now. So really that first lesson became all about mindfulness. And right. improv, I think, is so great about helping people learn mindfulness, not sitting there on a meditation cushion and saying, "Om," but in a way of looking around and saying, this is where I am right now. Nothing else matters. And now we can go. And so that's what I set out to do, is really stealing some of those exercises where you just look around and you point to things and you say, that's a chair, that's a table, that's the wall. And for me, I do that game that's in the book almost every day, because I am such a chronic overthinker. It's such a ingrained habit in me that my brain cannot point to things and call them what they are, and also think about the article that's due tomorrow
right.
and how, you know, I didn't pack the right lunch for my daughter, and whatever overthinking I'm doing, I can't do both at the same time. So it's a nice little way for me to snap out of overthinking and just be wherever I am.
And one of the other games that you sort of adapt is one that we call point and untell, which has actually been very successful when we've used with virtual audiences. And that's, you know, you put up a picture of an object and you tell people to say, name it anything than what it actually is. And what people discover is that's actually not very easy.
Yes. Yeah, we get stuck in literal thinking, especially as grownups. My daughter is 3 and she is great at not doing that. Like, she's very creative. And my hope is that she stays that way for as long as humanly possible, hopefully for her whole life. But because I'm not a kid and a lot of things were, you know, schooled out of me, it is difficult to point to something and call it the wrong name. And to do that, I just think opens up your divergent thinking, your creativity. But it's also a moment to not think about your, you know, what you don't love about your life or whatever chronic overthinking you're doing or anxieties. It's another break to just look at the world and look at it in a different way.
Yeah, I don't think we're not really taught anywhere that I can think about it right now how important it is to interrupt ourselves from the various things that we do that are ultimately not very healthy. I mean, we're overprogrammed. We get up too early. There's all these things that even in childhood this is happening. Like, we have all this science that tells us that, you know, like, hey, teenagers should sleep longer and they're going to be healthier and their minds will be better. Nope, we just cram them in school because it's a factory, and it's just it belies the intelligence that we have.
Yeah, and we overvalue that sort of type A. We overvalue overthinking. I was always rewarded for being the student who was constantly worrying about deadlines and, you know, pre-planning 8 steps ahead. I was always rewarded. I got A's. You know, the teacher pointed me out and, oh, we should all be more like Clay. No, like, that's not what we should be. The students who were thinking more creatively and not so anxious and in their heads should definitely be celebrated for being able to keep that sort of flexibility and not get stuck in those habits. So as a culture, I think we overemphasize and overreward the sort of type A overthinking, worry wart, work 70 hours a week approach.
Yeah. In the Calm the Hell Down chapter, one of the exercises is the nostril party. Yes. So I want you to take us through that.
Absolutely. So these, I've been taking yoga again because I'm at the age where if I don't start taking yoga, like things are going to start to give. And so I've been taking yoga. And so some of these breathing games were stolen from, mm-hmm. from yoga. I steal from all sorts of places. And Nostril Party is this yoga exercise where you plug one nostril and mm-hmm. breathe in through the other one and then pause, breathe out. And then you switch nostrils and breathe in, pause, breathe out. And you keep going back and forth. And for me, I like this Nostril Party exercise because the physicality of my hand on my nose helps to ground me. I can't, just like when I have to literally point to things and call them what they are, the actual pointing is an embodied thing that helps get me out of my head. And Nostril Party is the same for me, where I get to really like feel what it feels like to have my thumb on my nose and really take my time with the breathing. It's a pause, and there's a lot of science that says taking deep, slow breaths is the way to go if you want to calm the hell down.
Yeah, my friend Amy, who works with the Radical Candor Group, we were doing some prep planning for some workshops, and she does this work, and she led a small group of us through these breathing exercises. It was profoundly moving, and I felt different in my body for the entire day afterwards. I haven't been able to actually recreate that. I tried to do it on my own. I think for many of these things too, there's things you can do on your own, but there's also, you know, great teachers who can sort of lead you through. And I imagine that's what you discovered in yoga.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I added the breathing exercises because I, because of my overthinking and perfectionism and anxiety, I will go through most of the day and not really breathe. And I think that it sounds strange to say that because obviously I'm breathing because I'm still alive,
but not intentionally.
Yeah, not intentionally, but also not like a full breath.
Yeah,
like, I will really spend the day, you know, being anxious and go, 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 and really not take a full deep breath in my belly. And just to experience that, like that really helps me slow down and calm down and just take a pause. Because again, we're talking about habits. It's really easy to get stuck in that habit of just being hyper alert and just nonstop. And so breathing is a great shortcut for that.
So when the pandemic hit and we had to transfer all our gigs to virtual formats, one of the first exercises we introduced, and we still do it, and I want you to talk through the exercise Count to 10, because as you talk through it, you know, and it's so effective live in a room, I think you also realize then, oh, why would it be important in this sort of virtual session when we're all on screens?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, it's something that you can do by yourself, but it's mm-hmm. obviously an improv game or an acting game that groups can do as well. And so the game that I stole, you know, was the Count to 20. And it's mm-hmm. a group of people. Sometimes the teacher will have everyone or have the lights off and people close their eyes. And the idea is that you count to 20, but you can't, you go one at a time, and you can't go in any sort of set order. Like you can't create a pattern and sort of cheat. You're supposed to say the number when you feel like the number needs to be said. Like there's an impulse that the group needs the next number. If two people say the same number at the same time, you have to start over. And so what inevitably happens is people get frustrated or people mm-hmm. will start laughing. People will try to go really fast and they think that's the secret. But generally what the secret of the game is, spoiler alert, is to really take your time for everyone to slow down and give more space, more dead air, more quiet time. And then usually the group figures out that that's the way to get to 20. And so for me, I do this game. I hate when people tell me, you know, oh, just count to 10 or, you know, like,
yeah,
it's brutal. Like, don't do that. But I can tell myself to count to 10. If I'm getting worked up and frustrated or just, you know, I need to calm the hell down, I do that same impulse following. And I try to count to 10 by myself. So you'll just sort of stop. I always start with a breath, like it just sort of happens. And then I wait and say one when I feel like it's time to say one. And so by doing it that way, I get to 10 very slowly. I'm sort of getting in touch with what my impulses are. I'm giving some quiet time. And so it's almost like a meditative exercise to get to 10.
When we do this with the corporate clients, the conversation sort of midway through for us is talking about sort of prescriptive and non-prescriptive norms. So that you can, you know, if and this is why it's so important in the virtual settings, because the conversations are different. We don't have the ability to, we're not really looking each other in the eye. We think we might be, but we're not. And then there's all these other distractions. We're in our home and there's kids and there's pets and there's noise and all that. And so you can create prescriptive norms like, okay, let's just decide to go in order of the alphabet and our names, you know, and so you can make a list of these things. But really in life, as we know, we can't pre-plan that stuff. So we start to think of, all right, what are the non-prescriptive norms that we could employ in case we get into this kind of situation where these conversations are not going, when we're on top of each other, you know, mm-hmm. And that could be raising a hand, that could be, you know, the other stuff. And sort of you, and we just interviewed Fred Dust, who had a great book called Making Conversation. We don't understand that there is tons of design that can happen to make these conversations more effective. We have that agency. And as you sort of point out in the book, the agency starts with you getting your shit together, yeah. You know, calming down, but then maintaining a level of practice of this stuff, because our default setting is always going to be that not great place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so guilty of it as well, because if I think of an idea, I think of something I want to say, I don't have a great memory and mm-hmm. I want to say it right away. And so I, just like all the other lessons in the book, a lot of the lessons are, you know, for me to give myself tricks and tools to be a better listener, to give more air, to not make all the conversations about myself. And I think it's just important to have some shortcuts to be able to do that. And I love the idea of practicing this following your impulse with Zoom or virtual meetings as well. Mm-hmm. Because I've always disliked overly prescriptive, where it's like, mm-hmm. you're always first, you're always second. Yep. I always, you know, it just rubs me the wrong way, because that's not how people talk. That's not how we collaborate best, in my opinion. It just feels too forced and too strict. And so I would rather teach people how to follow their impulses and feel their impulses, mm-hmm. Even if we're not face to face.
Yeah. Second podcast in the last month that mentioned Debbie Downer. With all due credit to my friend Rachel Dratch, who invented that character in Saturday Night Live, you have a chapter called Killing Debbie Downer.
Yes.
Not literally, Rachel. We love you.
No. And my mom's name is Debbie, too. We're not killing her either. Yeah.
And you write in the book, quote, negativity is a tough habit to break. So talk to us about how improvisation attacks negativity.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, a big part of improv is a kind of positivity that's it's about being supportive. If someone has an idea, yeah, there's the yes and concept, but there's also for me optimistic is the wrong word, but it, you know, there's a positive mindset where you're really priming yourself to look for what you can work with and what's good. So if I'm thinking about my scene partner, in negative terms, like, oh, she always has bad initiations, or, mm-hmm. you know, oh no, I'm in a scene with him again. Like, the scene is not going to go well. It's not going to go as well as it could if I was thinking more positively, and open to all the things that could go well. So it was really important for me to translate that to everyday life, because I'm, you know, guilty of negative thinking. I'm guilty of, you know, hearing people sort of gossiping and talking negatively and then joining in. Because in the moment, it feels like yes and. Like, oh, we're all saying bad things about that thing or that person. Like, yeah, I'll join in. But that is, you know, that's a habit I want to break as well. Like, that's not great. Because then the next time I go to that place or see that person, I'm going to be primed to see more negative things about them. So it's again about habit breaking. And I think improv is a fun way to get into that childlike sense of wonder and positivity instead of being, you know, a grumpy Debbie Downer adult.
Yeah. And you follow that too by talking about something that I really connected to, which is the inclination to judge. And you had a sort of a take on this that I had not thought of before, where you say, quote, in improv, judgment is a way to pre-script a scene. And I hadn't thought about those terms, but I think it's very wise, because it's in judging, you've made a conclusion. Mm-hmm. You've ended this thing before it even started. And what a terrible way to exist.
Absolutely. And I think for me, I came to that realization because I do think about improv in terms of improv in everyday life. And so, you know, I do think when I'm judgmental, I am prescripting. And then I worked back and said, is that true in improv as well? And it absolutely is. When I say, you know, oh no, this, I'm in this room with this person and I have to talk to them and they're so boring, or they're so, like, I have just said that I'm going to have a conversation with this person and they will be boring. Instead of being open to the idea that this could be the one time, the first time that they really open up and say something interesting. And it just seems wildly unfair to do that.
Yeah. And I think that it's when you look at what the opposite of that is, I don't have the quote exact in my mind, but Frances Frey is a teacher at Harvard we had on the podcast, and she talks about leadership being the gift of someone else's transformation. Mm. You know, this, and I was like, I really keyed in on that, because I don't think I ever thought about leadership in that sort of, not just as a servant, but to really guide someone through their personal transformation. And you talk about this in the World of Genius, Geniuses section, that this idea of, you say, quote, we have the power to visualize others' greatness. Wow, that is not at all a flex I think most people walk around with.
Yeah, and it goes to the other lesson about you aren't special. I think we go around thinking that we are special, and why should we have to wait in line? Why should we not get our package in time? Like, how dare everyone? Because, you know, that, you know, I'm special and you're not seeing it. And we're often raised to think that. And to flip it and to think, I am no more or less special than anyone else. And my job is, and I want to preface by saying, I do not get this right often, right? Yeah. But it's aspirational, and I practice it as much as I can. I think it's my job to try to facilitate other people's greatness, mm-hmm. to leave it open to them doing great things. And I think in the book, I make it very clear that I am not perfect. I really
to great lengths, I might add.
But I think that's really important. Because, you know, how dare I not try to see other people's progress and growth and greatness? Because if you looked at me when I was 20 and just made a conclusion about me as a person forever and ever, that is awful. Because yeah. I've come such a long way in the past 20 years, in the past 30 years, in the past 40 years. And so, you know, I hope people can think in those terms of, you know, just like you want to be seen and heard and allowed to get better and better and better, like, do that for other people. See their greatness now.
Well, and this is, again, something that social science and actually comedy both have taught us. And my wife, I've talked about this before, has this idea that she talks about to her students around stand-up comedy. Stand-up comics are great perspective givers. So, you know, improv is great perspective taking of the audience, but perspective giving is the idea of, like, you know, within a second that Patton Oswalt is this dumpy, grumpy dude. And he is just, it immediately you connect because this person is being authentic in the moment with you and allows you to understand who they are. And then we can sort of share a community. Great leaders do that as well. The greatest leaders often sort of start with their faults. And you know, I think that that is a again, the not a muscle that people get to work on very often. But this book is all about you very much are like, hey, you need to put yourself in an uncomfortable position to get sort of used to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And writing this book and now, you know, having the book out there is that for me. I never thought I would put myself out there in this way where I was telling embarrassing stories and just being really open and honest. But, you know, it just became really, it was just really natural that it had to be that way. If I wanted other people to deal with their shame and embarrassment and put themselves out there and become more self-aware of what holds them back, like I had to do the same thing. And, you know, there's the lesson on embracing mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I was going to put an example in there, or the game is to, you know, reveal, like to fess up, to tell people about a mistake that you have not told people about. And I was going to add that and, you know, maybe give an example that actually people do know about. And instead, I gave an example that I have kept hidden and been embarrassed by since I was in the third grade. Like, mm-hmm. my mom didn't even know. Like, it mm-hmm. really, and when I was writing that embarrassing anecdote down, I was so sweaty. I was so, you know, and then, you know, my editor read it and then the proofreaders read it. And then I started telling people about it. And suddenly I felt it didn't have any more power over me. Yeah. And other people started saying, like, I have a super embarrassing story, you know, that yeah. happened to me in the bathroom that's really similar. And that kind of vulnerability seems scary. But I think often you're rewarded by people connecting with you and, you know, think about what we watch on TV. Like, we want to see humans. We want to see people with flaws. And we're drawn to those people who really lead with not just what makes them better. Like, that shouldn't be a part of the equation at all. It should be about connecting. And I think that comes with dealing with things we're embarrassed about.
And the other thing, and you offer this in a few different ways in the book, write it down. Like yeah. even just for yourself, write down the good stuff. I think you yeah. write down the bad stuff that we don't recognize that, you know, getting that output. And then again, you mentioned embodied earlier, and I think that's a really important thing because it is a true function inside of improvisation that it requires you to sync your body and your mind in a way that we don't always do. And so does that just simple writing expression. There's techniques like that have been used to treat people in trauma.
Yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
Which I guess is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was important for me, you know, because I am a teacher as well, to really mix up the different exercises and have some that are more embodied, some that are, you know, you could just sort of sit there and think something, you write something down. There's even an arts and crafts project because I, you know, people all are very different. And so yeah. it was important to have a big mix of different exercises. And I say, some of these are going to work, some of them aren't, but there's 120 of them, you know, get out there and see what happens.
Okay. So before I ask you for your yes and story, one of the areas in the book, and it comes up quite a bit, is just so fundamental to improvisation and so simple as well. And that is that listening is an art. That listening is, if you had to say to me, what's the one thing about improvisation that's like, if there was just one thing to take away, I would say it makes you a better listener and how crucial that has been to everything good that's happened in my life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I call that lesson shut up and listen because for me, a big part of the listening equation is the shut up part.
Yeah.
I'm super guilty of it, of interrupting. And, you know, like I talked about earlier, and in improv, because we are really, our job is to get the information and to have it go in your brain so you can use it later in the scene. And, you know, it just makes sense that should be our job when we're having a conversation. Like I shouldn't be thinking about what am I going to say next? Or, you know, oh, they talked about this and people laughed. Maybe I'll do this. Shut up. Listen. Really let it go into your brain and then go from there. And it's scary to do that because that's working without a script. And maybe it won't be a great conversation. But oftentimes it will be much, much better if you shut up, give some space, and really take all the nuggets that they're saying and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, I'll often ask the question, if you could make everyone in the world 5% better at listening, what effect would it have? Wow. I have yet to meet anyone who doesn't say, oh, it would be a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially if you look at, you know, where we are with politics.
You mean everything?
With everything.
With everything.
Everything. And part of that also goes back to improv is with really good listening comes trust, right? And what we talked about earlier, when we really see and hear people and listen and build off of their realities, we start to trust each other. And I think that is what is missing. And I think the way that you get there is by listening better. Absolutely.
And I think in our liberal circles, because we know who we are, there's a little bit of a fight right now with understanding that and historical inequity and agency and that, like, but none of it can't exist separate from each other. It just doesn't. Just like all these human beings who are on this planet have to work together because the opposite is pure nihilism and destruction. And so it's complicated. It's hard. We get all that. But the pursuit should be at least understood as something that needs to be all of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of exercises in the book and a lot of what I think about in terms of listening is it's really about letting people continue to talk instead of having a conversation that goes from what you want to talk about then to what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
And I think if we're doing that with people who have very different political beliefs or religious beliefs or whatever it is, it can seem really scary. I won't say who it is, but someone came over to my house, about a year ago or something and was really talking about QAnon. And just, and I really wanted to shut it down.
Yeah.
And then I told myself, you know, no, this person, just like all people, wants to be truly seen and heard. And so I went against my instincts and I just started asking questions because I didn't know anything about it. And it was important to her. And it didn't cost me anything for her to go on. And I learned all sorts of stuff and it was very interesting. And at the end of the conversation, you know, I said, you know, I had a great time with you. You know, it was fine, but you know, nothing, you know, you didn't convert me and I still think what I think. And she said, I just want to thank you for not judging me and for really listening to me because nobody really listens when I talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's how we end up where we end up is a lot of people not being seen and heard. A lot of people. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Maybe the biggest slam dunk setup in the history of the Yes And podcast to someone like yourself. Do you have a Yes And story for us?
I do. Of course I do. As I said, I have a 3-year-old daughter. When she was younger, she went through the phase of wanting to do things, you know, that didn't make any sense. And I guess kids do that all the time. But she, one day, I really wanted to Yes And. And she said, like, I want to eat this avocado, but I don't want you to cut it. You know, I just want the whole thing, you know, and she's 2 or something. And I really wanted to say, no, that's absurd. And then we would have gotten into a fight and a power struggle. And I just gave it to her and said, here you go. And she took it and she tried to take a bite and she just said, yucky. And then I said, oh, well, do you want me to cut it? And she goes, yes, please. And so I think that was my aha moment of Yes And is this really beautiful way to parent, not all the time. It's not about being permissive, but I learned that I say no to her when I don't want her to struggle and I don't want her to make a mess in my house. And so I now push myself to say yes. And sometimes that leads to a mess and it often leads her to struggle, but it also leads her to learn something for herself and for us to get along better.
Oh, just imagine you're the guy who wrote the Yes And book and your children, they just turned on me. And yeah, it was actually a great lesson because there was such richer conversations or interrogations that we're able to do when you just, you're sort of forced by shame to eliminate the word no from your conversations.
Yes, absolutely.
The book is called Play Your Way Sane, 120 improv-inspired exercises to help you calm down, stop spiraling, and embrace uncertainty. Clay Drinko, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly. This was great.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.